Hey, it's Matt. I've got some sad news. We lost a former guest of the podcast on Monday. Dale Chase died in his home on Hornby Island, British Columbia in Canada, from a heart attack. And he wrote a great book called A Journey to the Center of the Earth, as it turns out. It's really entertaining, full of great caving stories, and you can still get it. His brother, Dan Chase, is a member of our grotto. Dale started in Indiana and then moved to Canada. And so to Danny and everyone else who knew Dale, my condolences. Now, this was originally put up on February the 1st, 2018, my episode with Dale Chase on the Caving Podcast.
First of all, I thought I'd just read excerpts from the book. Most of my good caving stories are in here. In fact, almost all of them, you know, that are worth hearing.
Oh, sure. Yeah, and you're the author of a book called Journey to the Center of the Earth, not to be confused with the Jules Verne novel, but Journey to the Center of the Earth.
I got to tell you, Jules Verne stole my title before I was even born, that turkey.
So, Dale, this book, would you say that it's a comprehensive look at your whole caving life?
More or less, yeah. Well, out of hundreds and hundreds of trips, there's probably 50 or 70 in here that are about my caving trips, the best and the worst, the ones that make a good story. You know how it is. You do a trip and it'd curl the hair of most people that are listening. But non-cavers.
Well, non-cavers.
You, it's just routine. Yeah, we went through the hanging death breakdown and then through the bathtub and then through this. And if they could be there and do it, they'd be, oh, my God. But you, it's just routine, eh? It's what you do if you're a caver.
That's what I say.
So
when did you start caving? Like, what were your first caves?
First cave, I'm just about to read it to you. Shiloh Cave.
Oh, Shiloh. That's a good one.
I always knew I wanted to go into caves as far back as I can remember. My first exposure was at maybe 6 or 7 years old, watching Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. What struck me was their diamond mine. Finding diamonds seemed okay, but what really grabbed me was the cave-like mine extending off into the darkness. But anyway, with more experience and acquaintance with the caving world, we learned that Shiloh Cave is one of the more visited caves in Indiana. Troops of Boy Scouts and church groups do the half-mile through trip regularly, but we knew nothing about caving except you needed a light, and we knew nothing about this cave. If someone with credibility has told us it was infinitely long and come out in China, we would have packed a lot more batteries and candy bars and double-layered the aluminum foil on the batteries. Our lack of knowledge increased the magic, the mystery, the sheer adventure. And when we came out the lower entrance, it smelled like victory. I never got over it. It may be an easy, short cave, but to us, it was a journey to the center of the earth, and I'm still on this trip. It's seventh grade science class. The lessons today is about limestone and caves. I have more important business, looking out the window and dreaming of caves, when Jim Williams nudges me and whispered, "I know where there's a cave," he says. This felt like and was a life-changing revelation. After class, we made a plan. 9 o'clock Saturday, 5 miles out of town in the tiny village of Eureka, a manageable bike ride. The name of the cave is Shiloh Cave. We had no other info. My younger brother, Daniel, jumped on the opportunity to join us. This is 1959. We had a handheld flashlight in each hand. Fearless we were. Well, almost. The entrance was large, and we climbed down a small mountain of broken rock. "This must have fallen from the ceiling," said Daniel. I silently said, "Gulp."
That's great. You're right. This is written in just sort of a very laid-back style, and I really love it.
Well, buy the book, you cheapskate. My big dream for this book is to break even. I'm such a computer idiot that I've had to hire help for the pictures and editing and actually, now you've got a whole manuscript. Now you got to get it into the format to publish. It's like the Gambler's Prayer. dear God, let me break even because I need the money.
Well, so. I mean, what you've done is what I've heard so many cavers say they're going to do, because these stories and these experiences are so powerful in our minds that we say, you know, there's a book in here. You know, I could write a book about this cave, or I could write a book about my caving life, or I could, you know, and you've actually done it. So there's got to be some pride along with that.
Well, I think I've done enough. I've got a pretty good collection of stories here. This story is about when we started vertical caving. We got ourselves a brand new 150-foot manila rope, state-of-the-art in Indiana in 1962. We signed out all the cable ladders from the Bloomington, Indiana grotto and pumped ourselves up for our debut into vertical caving. Our descent technique was over-the-shoulder rappel, a diaper sling with a carabiner, then over a heavily padded shoulder. Rappel down, use the descent rope for a belay, safety first, on the cable ladder. We practiced on a steep side hill near Tony's house and proclaimed ourselves ready. Out to the farmer's pit. We're stoked. Tony was first down. Off rope, he says. Down, I followed him into a large room with a steep talus slope. The 75-foot drop with another 75 feet of dead animal talus on the bottom. The smell was a maggot gagger. Cows, horses, pigs, dogs, cats. Oh, and George. Oh, no, that's another cow. There were some hilarious moments when one of us would step on a boulder that was actually a dead cow. The crowning moment happened when the skin slipped off, entailing a backflip into the gore of a rotting pig. The crowd went wild. Tony made the most of it by sitting on the dead pig and eating a cheese sandwich. We named it Carcass Crypt. The new owner of the property had been unaware of the pet cemetery use of the pit and vowed to see that it didn't continue.
Oh, that's so you named it Carcass Crypt?
Yeah, I think we were the first people down it, yeah.
That's so funny. It's one of my favorite vertical trips ever in Indiana has been to Carcass Crypt. I took a late night trip there, yeah. and I loved it, and I want to see it during the day because it's such a big hole that I'm sure the sun shines down in it. And I knew that it got its name from a story like that, and it's such a delight to hear it from you who were there first. That's so great.
Are there dead animals down there now? Has the smell gone away? It was awful. It was really a lot of dead animals. I think all the neighboring farms brought, you know, their pet cemetery candidates and just dumped them into the hole.
It was, I definitely saw some bones down there, but that was probably 5 or 6 years ago now. So it's been a while. And of course, it's fenced off now.
Well, this was 50 years ago, more. Yeah. 1962, 55 years ago, we did this. We also got into a little mischief in southern Indiana caving, and in the afternoon, we decided to stop. We can't afford to take the tour in Wyandotte. We decided to stop by and look at the entrance. And look, the gate, it's bent up. With an exhale squeeze, you could get under it. We drive the little road, the gravel road out there, and there's a convenient, almost discreet parking place. Now it's dark, and we're back, and we're doing the deed. It was an impressive cave and great fun. Stolen watermelon is always the sweetest. After the junction leading to the Pillar of the Constitution, two of us decided to see that part of the cave instead of the tourist routes. I'd heard that the Indians used to go back and mine the flowstone to make stuff, pipes in particular. And the pipes made of this flowstone had been found all up and down the Mississippi River drainage. The Ohio River is close by via the Blue River, and there's many thousands of miles of canoe navigable river right handy. It's not all easy going. In the low spots, there are soot marks from the shagbark hickory torches they used. Was it a mile? Quite the endeavor with torches. The pillar itself was huge and impressive in a large room. Altogether a fun trip. We came out and went to the car, but no car. Pretty soon it came by and picked us up. We got the story of the other three culprits. When they came out, there was old man Rothrock, the owner, with the shotgun. He escorted them to the office and extorted four times the admission price from them. "You wouldn't really shoot us, would you?" "No," he said, "but I might shoot out a couple of tires and call my buddy the sheriff. One of our guys didn't have the money, so his watch was graciously accepted in lieu." They were stand-up culprits and never mentioned the two of us had split off. At this point, the old guy became downright cordial and got them each a free pot from the machine. "Some days," he said, "I make more money from that bent fence than I do from customers. I had the pullout made special for just this type of occasion. I check it for cars every night. I bent the fence myself."
No kidding.
In the early 60s, the state bought Wyandotte Cave. It became a state park. First, they actually fixed the fence, then decided they needed to know what they had bought. So they got Dick Powell from Indiana University to arrange to survey it. Dick asked me if I'd like to be part of this, room, board, minimum wage. I had to think a while. Let's see. One of Indiana's finest caves. I get fed and motelled while they do this, and they pay me. Considering that I probably would have paid them to let me in on this, it didn't take too long to come up with, yes! There were eight of us, and we divided into two teams. One team would survey the show cave portion and out to the Pillar of the Constitution. I was put on the B team to survey all the back end and hardest parts. Great. We spent 4 days at this, and I got to see most of the cave, my name on the survey, and a nice little check in the mail. Only downside was I still hadn't seen some of the show cave parts. We rectified that later when we made a family expedition to see the commercial portions. It was grand. I even got in free when I showed them my name on the survey, though the rest of the family had to pay. So I got to see all of Wyandotte, never paid a penny, and got paid instead.
That's so great. So you were part of that group that told the state essentially what they had when they bought Wyandotte and made it into a park.
Yeah, actually, I haven't seen it all. The Danny Dibel and Ron Adams crew, was it Easter Pit?
Yeah, they connected Easter Pit back in the late 80s, yeah.
Yeah, I heard about the connection. I found really fascinating because the story I heard from them is they came to the end of a little side passage, couldn't go anymore. And they got down on their belly and looked through the tiny hole, and there was a flash bulb.
Yeah, an antique flash bulb.
So they dug their way through, and then they went and talked to Wyandotte about their discovery.
Actually, I think they waited until like 2000 or 2001 before they told them.
So oh, yeah.
They waited over 10 years before they presented it to the state.
As a done deal.
Yeah, exactly. They wanted to make sure they surveyed it and pushed it as far as it would go before they told the state, and probably sat on it a few more years after that just to kind of keep it to themselves. And good for them.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
So you spent a lot of time in Mexico, too. You did a lot of deep drops down there. You found some stuff down there. Do you have anything on that?
Well, yeah. Geo Lucifugus goes to Mexico, Chapter 11. We've been following the exploits of Terry Raines, Bill Russell, and others in the Big Deep Caves of Mexico. In August 1964, the NSS convention was held in Bloomington, and these two showed up. I remember that when I saw them, it was with the awe that others might have given to Bob Dylan or Mickey Mantle if they showed up at the neighborhood pub. I was too shy around these gods to even introduce myself or butt in on their conversations. Anyone who knows me will be shaking their head at this, but there it is. In my mind, they really were a big notch above and far beyond. That fall, Bob Hosley decided we were ready for a trip to Mexico. To say we greeted the concept with enthusiasm would be an understatement. The big drawback for us was financing it. Well, the upshot of it was that Bob collected $60 from each of us and said he'd pay all the vehicle and all group expenses, including even the odd beer and all the food. What an unbeatable deal for us. And actually an unbeatable deal for him, since he got the unbeatable pleasure of our company. The most memorable of the caves on that trip was Ventana Hoboli, Window of the Wild Boar. Everything about it was grander than we'd ever seen. The huge entrance on a cliff face, the enormous passage with skylights and big hills of deep bat guano. One of the skylights was a 503-foot freefall into the passage. At the time, I believe it was the deepest known drop in North America. We ain't no dummies. We decided to stop at a Mexican hardware store and buy twine to drop the pit. And we'd haul up the rope with the twine rather than cliff climb with a 600-foot rope. It seems in Mexico they sell twine by the kilogram. Kilogram? What's that? How long is a kilogram? We weren't really metricized at all. Jim had rudimentary high school Spanish. Bob spoke metric, sort of. Finally, the Mexicans got the idea we wanted a specific length. So they made a rough estimate in meters. Oh, and how long is a meter? Oh, about 3 feet. Okay. Well, like the constipated mathematician, we worked it out with a pencil. By now you, dear reader, know where this is going. A late start. Up the cliff at Ventana Hoboli. There are three of us, fortunately, carrying up rappelling gear and twine. By tying all our combined shoelaces, it just made it. Bob and Tony waited at the bottom to tie on the rope. We pull it up. We drop the pit. Woo-wee! Now we're all at the bottom, and the rope is tied off at the top. Well, Dale climbed the cliff again while Tony climbed the rope, and we met at the top. Tony must be the only, or nearly so, person who climbed the drop but didn't rappel it. We drop the rope, and on the way down, Dale ends up hanging onto a small tree with his legs flailing in midair over one of the skylights. Oh, God. Tony takes off his belt to reach me a handhold. The rest of the trip down was an uneventful cliff climb of a couple hundred feet. When Dan'l remembers that, he still rags on me about how stupid I can be, but at least I'm lovable.
Were you one of the first people to drop Golondrinus? I know Dan was one of the first people to do it back in the day, but were you with him on that trip?
No, I wasn't on that trip. I had hitchhiked to San Francisco and spent the summer doing bad things.
Wait, was this 1967?
Yeah.
You were one of those people.
Yeah. Well,
that's great. So
a bit about Blue Springs.
Oh, Blue Springs in Indiana, yeah.
This is a long chapter. It's probably 10 pages long. I'll just go through some bits of it. We visited the Call Glazer farm for a look at the entrance. Funny how farmers are the busiest people in the world, but always have at least half an hour or more to yak. 45 minutes later, finally the talk comes around to the subject of the cave. The sinkhole entrance was a sinkhole pond till the big rains in the spring of 1940. The bottom dropped out of the pond, and there was that big hole leading down to the river passage in the cave. Well, he says, I guess it would be all right if you boys had a look at things. There were six or seven of us, and a couple of them had inner tubes, but the rest of us waded and swam from one mud bank to another. Swimming in boots and cotton sweatshirts was cold. Cold and a little scary and cold. We need a boat. Jim had a long schmooze with the Call Glazers, and we got permission to put a boat in there. Well, our good old buddy Bill Ira had a beat-up old aluminum boat, a 12-footer. It could crowd in six just fine as long as there was no waves and we didn't tip the thing at all. No leaks, though. I can let it go for $20. We jumped on it, took up a collection, and we were the proud owners. We got it into the cave where it lived for years, surviving a number of flood episodes. Occasionally had to be ducked out of the mud and gravel after a flood, but that's how it goes. Time for some serious cave exploration. We had a trip where Dan'l and Mike Means went in and pushed some breakdown aside, found the second discovery, got ourselves through the maze, found the first discovery. It was a grand day. On our first 9 survey trips with Art Palmer, well, we did 2 survey trips on our own, but we didn't have a way to make a line plot. Then we met Art Palmer, and he was just starting his doctoral thesis on groundwater and caves and karst in the area just west of Bedford. Blue Springs was in there, and he jumped on the opportunity to survey it. On our first 9 trips with Art, we averaged a mile of passage each time. The second discovery yielded more than 5 miles, like 95% of that's walking passage, most of it big walking passage. Exploration continued. Jim and I went to the end of the first discovery and went through a bathtub with really tight airspace. It was scary. But we got through, no wetsuits, just our usual cotton clothes, which is stupid, but that's how it was then. Yeah, and sometime in 1965 or 1966, Art announced the Blue Springs was number 6 longest cave in the world. Number 6. We were really proud of ourselves and our cave. Cave exploration was young then. And Blue Springs topped out at about 21 miles, while hundreds of other caves in the world got bigger. Still, it was a fine way to spend our youth.
That's great stuff. Yeah, so you were there at the beginning of Blue, well, not the beginning, but at the big exploration of Blue Spring.
Oh, yeah.
6 longest. It's hard to imagine that Blue Spring in Indiana, of course, we're talking about not Tennessee, but Blue Spring was the 6th longest cave mapped in the world.
I'll make a wild guess. Is it number 50 in the United States?
Who knows? It's got to be, yeah, something like that.
I'd be very surprised if it's in the top 20. But it's still a grand cave. As far as big passage goes, the percentage of big passage in Blue Springs, I bet it's 90% walking. A lot of that's big walking. Whereas somewhere like Mammoth Cave, I was in on a bit of exploration at Mammoth Cave. I would make a guess that 30 or 40% of Mammoth Cave is walking high. We went on one trip in Mammoth Cave, went in the pole entrance, which is a mine tunnel by the Army Corps of Engineers, and you pop into this big borehole passage, except the borehole has so much breakdown that mostly you're crawling between the breakdown and the ceiling with occasional stretches of big passage. You get to Swinnerton Avenue, and in my memory, it was a mile long. And it was walking. It had nice gypsum. It was beautiful. But then there's a mile of duck walk passage, more or less like the backbreaker in Sullivan's. A mile of it. Oh, God, my legs were burning. And then we hadn't even got to the hard part. Several hours of knee and belly crawls and contortions, and finally arrived at our destination, did some surveying, and it's back out. Hard sledding, Mammoth Cave. Blue Springs was actually a lot friendlier despite the water. So, yeah, our hardest trips in Blue Springs were probably easier than the average trip to Binkley's now. You interested in hearing about the Mars trip?
Oh, yeah, that was on my list. Yeah, so what was that all about?
This is some years ago when the first little Mars vehicles were driving around taking pictures, and they discovered pretty certain evidence that there was once water on Mars. First, we were talking about a cave trip, undersubscribed, which probably means no one else wanted to go. Can't understand why. This was proposed by Joe Oliphant. He put it in the BC Caver, an ad, you know, looking for a crew. Into the mountains of Montana, the Silvertip area in January. Snowmobile for many miles. Then ski or snowshoe many more miles into camp. Expect blizzards and minus 20 degree temperatures. The goal would be wetsuit trips into the lower wet caves as they are at lowest water in midwinter. Sounds like great fun, but we were all too busy. And when we got, you know, we were saying, God, what could be harder? Well, how about a Mars trip? That could be even harder. We sort of bullshitted about that for a while, and I put together all the ideas that came up. The recent discovery that Mars once had a lot of waters inspired us to announce the next SpeleoFest. NASA being privatized means we can charter a flight to Mars. Big opportunity. We leave from Cape Canaveral unless the Russians come in with second world technology at a better price. We'll spend 2 years getting there. Boredom might be a problem, so pre-flight training exercises will include a grueling regimen of couch yoga, long naps, TV ads, political speeches, an alcoholic stupor. Costs are user supply unless we can find a sponsor. We're submitting a grant proposal to the Federated Union of Cave and Car Studies. Numerous space movies prove that decisions are best made by whoever yells the loudest. And since this is already our standard mode, we should be naturals. The toilet, finally, the toilet will probably have all the bugs worked out. The first 23 shuttle missions, they changed the toilet every time. They totally redesigned it. I wonder why. One almost foolproof design had a fan that was put in backwards, with unspeakable results. Space sickness, which involves uncontrollable projectile vomiting, should not be a problem for such greats as ourselves. Upon landing in the bottomless crater in the abysmal plain, we will be less than 200 clicks from the Carbonate Mountains. We should be able to hike there in a couple weeks. No big hurry, because it's 1.42 years till the next return launch window. Our pack should be smaller than a bread truck, but in one-third gravity of Mars, they won't weigh as much. There is the option of the anti-gravity unit, but it's still experimental and is probably too heavy. The cave should be dry, so maybe we won't need to use our wetsuits and the spare rubber dinghy. Sensitive use of the photon blaster will vaporize pools of frozen methane and carbon dioxide. What makes the trip really easy is that we can use 2 mil rope. Well, maybe 3 mil on the trade routes. Light gravity also means the plungers should work even better, so no need for a hammer drill. For the survey, we'll take an extra pencil this time. Dig should be easy with a 45 gallons of universal solvent, if we can figure out how to package it. Dress warm. Cave temps will probably be in the minus 50s centigrade. Water shouldn't be a problem, assuming the still suits work as they should. The more you sweat, the more you can drink, and the more you recycle, the tastier it gets. Cooking will be a bit of a problem with no firewood and little oxygen. Extensive personal research has proven the best nutrition for the least weight is dog biscuits. I'm partial to the liver flavor myself. Ground up fine with granola bars, pounded into Nalgene's. Anyway, we don't want to overeat because the spacesuits have no provision for toilet functions. So we will have to consider the limited supply of Depends to be group gear and recycled and shared appropriately. Food will start to run short, so we will call the successively weaker members as protein donors. Oh God, I hope some little fat weak people show up. Said donors will donate their credit cards to the last ones in hopes of having enough to finance the trip home. If the weather deteriorates on the last day, as usual, we'll think about hiking back. So, the Mars trip, well, it's still undersubscribed.
Can we talk about the plunger real fast, the Petzl plunger, since you mentioned it in that story?
Well, yeah, toilet plungers. There you go.
And that's the back cover of the book, right? That's the back cover?
Yeah, it's on the back cover. Yeah, I thought it was a great little picture for the back cover. People look at that and they say, is that suction cups? It looks like toilet plungers. Yep. You know, the bow and the toilet plungers, the arrow, you just shoot it up and pock it onto the ceiling, climb up. Install a second anchor as soon as possible. Safety first, you know.
Of course.
And then you can just pock them onto the floor and tie them off, use several, and there's your anchor for the pits, and lash them to your feet, one in each hand, and pocka, pocka, pocka right up the wall.
Fair enough.
The plungers are better done as a picture display than a description, you know, and that's in here. There's, a dozen how-to-do-it pictures of plungers. So I moved to Vancouver Island, where I live is a little island just in the Strait of Georgia. We're actually part of Vancouver Island. The ferry takes us to Vancouver Island, and most of my caving after I came to Canada was on Vancouver Island.
And so when did you move to Canada? When was that?
I moved there in 1968. I left Indiana on a Honda 90 motorcycle My luggage was a gym bag that rode on my lap. And I crossed the border March 24th. I was due to be inducted on the 25th. Got to Toronto to the anti-draft league. Found me a billet. And then the next day, I found a job. And the next day, I had my own room, you know, a grubby little room. Actually, Canada welcomed me with open arms. And I never really got any negative feedback about being a draft dodger. So of my Vancouver Island cave, and I've been to most of the significant caves on Vancouver Island, but most of my caving time there has been spent at Weimer Creek, which just opened itself up in 1990. Here's the story. In 1990, Merv Mitchell and his son Charlie, Tim Penny, and myself have been caving in the Tassus area, and we're sitting in the pub at Tassus. Across the inlet is a big, freshly logged limestone area. "We should check that out," said Merv. Dale pooped on the idea, being the know-it-all caving genius that he is. There's no vehicle access. The logging was done with a barge in show. That means all the vehicles got barged across the inlet and onto that road system, which doesn't connect to anything. It's a huge hike from sea level. Most of the caves up there at 2,500 feet. It all just been clear cut. In the summer, there's zero shade as you're climbing the hill with big, heavy packs. It was too much slash, probably wouldn't find anything, blah, blah, blah. So Tim Penny went out to the vehicle and brought in some binocs. He looked for a while and said, "There's a cave." Oh, when he directed our eyes, we could see it without binocs. Tucked into a gully a little way below the hanging valley there. My reaction? Probably another shadow cave. Knock yourselves out. I got other plans next weekend. So they went up and found Whistling Cave, a walk-in resurgence with a sizable stream and a tremendous air draft. They came back with a picture of this walk-in entrance with toilet paper streaming out horizontally. Big smiles showed me. So you charter a boat, camp at the old logging landing, hike up each day and back down on the logging road system. Many clicks and 2,200 feet to Whistling. Higher up, it's the lowest elevation large cave on the mountain. Nice views, but full sun and hot as blazes in the summer getting up there. Quickly, Rec 8 teams found the Slot Canyon Cave, Fallen Giant, and Headwall. All must-see caves and much more. My reaction? Oh, I knew the area would be a winner. You can just tell. Yeah, right. Most of the caves found are still in first growth, but there are road line ribbons and falling boundaries everywhere. One of Vancouver Island's largest limestone outcrops in first growth was about to get the rest of itself scalped. But that's another story. It got made into a provincial park instead. So there's beautiful entrances, nice big trees. It's a great place. Grand caves. So Skypod. Martin was looking at aerial photos of the area and found a big black hole higher up. They checked it out. A 20-meter diameter pit, 20 meters deep, and going passage with a good draft. Time for me to jump aboard this gravy train. I talked to Ron Kozan about this, and he said, yeah, come along. If it goes, we'll call it Indiana Dale and the Orifice of Doom. I'm in! Who could resist that, huh? The walk-up was sweltering, of course. Eight of us descended the pit, surveying as we go. Another rope drop, short bolt climb by Titch Morris, another 20 meters on rope, and we hear a large streamway below us. Yes! We managed to climb down to a large, dry, horizontal passage with an unusual cross-section. The ceiling was like the inside of a circus tent roof, i.e. a peak in the middle with 30-degree downslant. It averaged 8 to 10 meters wide and walking high. The floor was big, flat slabs, sloping from the middle at the same 30-degree angle, generously coated with mud, slick as boogers. We called it the Big Top. There's a lot of slipping and crashing into the wall, but no one got hurt. Next trip, an easy climb down to the much easier stream level was found. I don't think anybody's been to the Big Top since. We ended up in a place with many phalactites. You know what they are. Murr says, looks like a nun's nightmare to me. The name stuck. We surveyed down a large, pleasant streamway to the sump and routed. 75 stations and a lot of new passage with primo leads. It took a long time to get the overly large crew out. We stumbled down the mountain. Martin still laughs at the memory of a bunch of punch drunks tripping on every small rock on the logging roads. It was almost dawn when we got back, and I was starved, but too tired to eat or even drink a beer. That's tired. The cave got named Skypot, much to Dale's disappointment, but it's a great and fitting name. So that was one of the harder trips on Vancouver Island.
Oh, well, another great one.
That was an epic grunt. Ah, here's one of my favorite trip reports. This is Weimer Creek, 99 cave collapsed. We got named because it used to just be a head wall and no entrance at all. Not a dramatic head wall. And it definitely was an overflow resurgence, but you couldn't get in. 1999, big floods undermined some of the breakdown, collapsed inward, and now you could get in. And 99 turned out to be the cave that will hopefully connect the lower system and the upper system. And if we connect them, we have the longest cave in Canada.
Oh, wow.
It would be 22 clicks if we connect them, which by Indiana standards even isn't humongously long. But you got to realize these caves are hard sledding. There's very little walk along one foot in front of the other. That hardly happens. So anyway, we're at 99 Cave, to the end of exploration via Organic Avenue. We're in, I scare myself again. At this point in time, we've connected 99 and Slot Canyon systems. Now we're pushing leads to find a connection to the Ursa Major system, thus giving us the longest cave in Canada. Hasn't happened yet, but we're on the case. There have been a lot of adventurous trips in this cave, but this is one of the diciest. Organic Avenue has been dug out and is irresistibly close to the end of exploration in this portion of 99 Cave. This is just Martin and I. When choosing a route, always make sure that at least some of it has no wasted space. Ideally, it would be right at the beginning of the trip and have a low ceiling with plenty of squishy mud and some unavoidable puddles. Right, Organic Avenue it is then. This is one of the newest of the 30 entrances to the combined system. It neatly avoids a lot of much longer and harder access, found by Randy Brochu and dug out by many, including me, in four trips. It's 40 meters long, damp crawl, tight enough that a bag is really hard to push through because you can't bend your arms. So we come up with a plan to get the heavy gear bags through by tying them to a stout string, one pulling, one pushing. So yeah, we got them through. Now we're high above the lower level at the rope drops. One down, one up, then down again. These three rope drops we call the Jungle Gym, a vertical dance on wide natural bridges 100 feet plus or minus off the floor. This leads to an intermediate level needing only a floor to be pleasant, and there you are, the end of exploration, only about 200 meters from the new Organic Avenue entrance. There are phreatic tubes visible across the void. Dale did a dicey climb with a creative belay, to access the upper level, needing only a traverse handline to glory. Martin was impressed. There were no natural anchors and no rock walls, just sloping mud walls to volcanoes. So we put a bolt in the ceiling and attained the next obstacle. The first two phreatics fizzled, but the best was right below us. Here was a fine natural anchor, a wormhole through solid rock. We fastened also to the end of the traverse line. Below is a tight manhole, about 2 feet long, quite tight, dropping another 6 feet into the target phreatic. So it's an 8-foot drop, but the 2 feet of it are scary tight. Dale decided it was just large enough and descended till encased, hips to chest, feet dangling in midair. Then I decided the crux might be too small for my manly chest. Overcome by common sense, he hollered, "I want out of here!" Martin pulled and I thrashed till it became obvious a 3-part block was needed and would take some time to rig. I thought about it a while and decided my arse had probably grown more than my manly chest, and slid on down, leaving only a trace of a crawl impression on the chest. Martin was unimpressed with my whole performance here. Before he came down, I made sure it was possible to climb back up through the manhole. You couldn't bend your elbows, so I made a longer foot loop and tether on the jammer so it was overhead and got out okay. I managed 4-inch strokes on the climb, but it was only 8 feet. So back down into the manhole. Now we're both in fine, level, clean drafting tube, 4 feet high and 6 feet wide leading on. We scoop to another rope drop. Maybe the next stop on this route is Ursa Major. The drop is deeper than the rope we have left, and by the time we get out, it will be enough fun for one day. From this side, we find a place that could simplify things by rigging a bit of a pendulum over the void and flip the end back to the next guy. We're routing. At the bag-pulling crawl, we found the twine had rolled itself into a muddy tangle in our absence. So we tied both bags to Martin's foot with a short chunk of webbing. With me pushing, he grunted him through the tight corner, thereby stretching one leg enough to make him hodag capable for clockwise traverses on his upcoming tree planting job. Back at the car, the road pops were unusually tasty, and we laughed in giddy delirium at the sheer adventure of it all. Can't understand why more people don't do this. Anyway, we dropped that, and we just reconnected ourselves back into the known cave. Well, poop. A sad story. So, how about I read you a real adventure story where I'm not the bozo?
Well, that sounds good.
This is a grand trip, awesome cave. It's called Close to the Edge.
Let's go for it.
It's in northern BC in the Rocky Mountains. Closest population center is probably Prince George. It's an 800-foot shaft with a rebelay at 400 feet. A short passage at the bottom leads to a 90-foot drop, and at the end of exploration, a too-tight crevice with wind roaring through it. It sounds like a waterfall as you approach. Yeah, you think you're coming to a waterfall, and it's just air going through a 3-inch-wide crack. The entrance is quite large, 40 feet high, 30 feet wide, thereabouts. A horizontal entrance. The drip line at the entrance is just outside the edge of the drop. There is a crumbly sloping ledge around the right side of the shaft leading to the obvious rig point. One could rig this shaft to avoid the rebelay, but it speeds up ascents to have two people on rope. So the top half of the shaft is 100 feet in diameter. The bottom half may be 100 by 40 or 50 feet. No one's really measured the thing because you can't, although it can now be done easily with disto. So I guess someday we'll find out how close our estimate is. The rebelay ledge is quite large. A person can stroll around on it, but there's nowhere with rock protections, and the pack rats scurry around the top, knocking off frost shatter. The average seemed to be about one per hour. They are odd-shaped and average more or less the size of a baseball. Falling, they shriek, roar, and or flutter, depending on shape. Scary shit, as at least one can be expected during any ascent. Ice formations, some as big as school buses, decorate the walls. Most have already come off by late August, but the rest might or might not hang on till freeze-up. There's a stream that enters the far side of the top and splashes enough to fill the whole place with rain and mist. Rick Black was an avid ice climber. He figured the stream makes an 800-foot ice climb here in the winter. National Geographic stuff for the really adventurous. The bottom of the first shaft is more or less flat with big rocks, and off to one side is an alcove where one can hide from rocks right at the top of the 90-foot drop. At the bottom of the 90-foot drop is the lead, the roaring crevice. It's our objective to get past this crevice this trip. The bottom of the main shaft is cold, damp, and windy. It's torture to wait for the slow pokes to ascend. At the top, pack rats are eager to steal food and chew ropes and pack straps. Thank God we don't have them on Vancouver Island. Having said all this, I must add this place is stunningly beautiful. It's awesome. But actually, it's probably the scariest cave I was ever in because of the rock fall. When you hear those rocks coming down, I know it's 100 feet in diameter, and your profile is like a foot and a half or 2 feet in diameter, and they So far, they've always missed, but the way they sound, if they hit you, it'd be bad news.
Oh, my goodness. I can imagine.
Yeah, spontaneous rock falls, really scary. The hike in is several miles of gentle grade to a stream crossing with a cable chair made by the Devil's Club hikers. After the stream crossing, it's relentlessly uphill, another 3,000 feet of elevation gain. Camp is in the topmost copse of trees just at the timberline. Day one, the Albertans, the Albertans arrive and carry up their first load. Day two, the rest of us arrive. We all load up and take off. The Albertans leave us in our dust and arrive at camp hours ahead of us. I'd like to attribute this to their lighter packs because they carried half of it up yesterday, but I have to say they're a tough bunch. After setting up camp and eating, we visit the entrance. We hang over the cookie tosser, the big flat rock that overhangs the shaft, and gawp at the huge and seemingly bottomless hole. Day three, Monday, the last group here, an American crew, has left their rope rigged. It's a real pain in the ass. It can't be trusted after a winter of ice and rock fall, and it is rebelayed at the ledge, so we can't just pull it up. It's inevitable that our rope wraps around it. The author's feelings about this rope in no way reflect on our bozo American comrades. Dale waffles the least and is elected to go down to the ledge and sort things out. I unhook the American rope from the rebelays and put ours onto the boats. We try to haul the cursed dumb shit American rope, but it's wrapped around or under breakdown at the bottom. We decide to go with the will of fate and leave this cursed rope in place for now. We can work around it. Dale rigs the ledge and prepares to ascend. He gets to try his rope walker system. Works great. I love it. Several people borrowed it. It was used every day. We spend the rest of the day gardening the entrance area and the trail from camp, which is slightly hairy. As you go over the edge of a cliff and get on a 3-foot ledge for 50 meters or so to the cave. We set some rat traps in the entrance with foolproof bait, peanut butter. Tuesday, ratless traps. The boogers have sprung the traps, eaten the peanut butter, and shit copiously on everything. Take that, bipedal primates. Three of the guys descend the pit, the blasting wires sent down to them. Of course, it obstinately wraps around everything, especially the misbegotten American rope. Blasting wire is dual purpose. It carries the signal of our low-power CB radios and connects the blasting caps to the surface. Our first communication with the bottom is Ron's voice. The turkey has landed. The rope for the 90-foot drop is rigged. Merv descends. At the lead, all start to dig in the clay at the bottom of the crevice. They leave the drafting dig in a vertical crevice when they can no longer reach down to pull stuff out. As per plan, they wire up a blasting cap to the wire in a safe place and climb to the surface. Once up, we test the cap system. Makes quite an echoing bang, but not a pebble falls. Jill points out that ascending this pit with a frog system is like doing 800 push-ups on a waterbed. Rick has placed his leftover lunch pack high on a ledge. No rat is going to make a 4-foot leap and a 5'12" overhung climb to get it while we watch. A rat does just that and is sniffing avidly at his pack. We rebait the traps, this time with surefire bait, peanut butter, raisins, and old rope. Ha! Day five, Wednesday, no rats. We concede. Other than eating rope and gear, smelling like skunks, and carrying bubonic plague and hantavirus, yeah, this was in the news the summer before, they would be quite lovable. Dale and Rick blacked us in. When we get to the bottom, Rick solemnly shakes my hand and says, Dale, this is my fourth time up here and the first time I even got to the bottom of the first drop. Thank you. Apparently, secure in the knowledge that no pit in the Rockies at the time was more than 140 feet, they had been plagued by ropes too short to reach down the first drop. One trip, they had enough rope, but the snowpack was gone, the streamway dry and no water to be had. Trip over, right now. The new dig, we concur, the new dig is the best place for the charges and wire up everything. Backfill several feet of clay stomach and climb out. As for safety protocols, the pit is de-rigged in case of rock falls. This is made harder by a rope wrapping around the American rope. We set off the charge with all the stomach. It's no louder than the Cap alone was, not a Pebble Falls. Thursday, last day in the cave, down the mountain tomorrow. Steve Coots arrives in camp with coffee, fresh cream, toilet paper. On cave trips, toilet paper is sometimes called mountain gold, and liquid refreshment. Bless you, Steve. Dave Matthews and Jean-Pierre Bovin re-rig and descend. They found our blast has had an admirable effect. It's still a dig, but now the spill can go down the hole. After some hours of digging, there's just a short constriction over the next drop. They rig the charge and pair to ascend. Meanwhile, ominous thunderheads have built up and a lightning storm is approaching. The decision is to pull the charges, derig, and pull everything up. The lightning misses us by a wide margin, but better safe than in the news. That night, around the campfire, all liquid consumables are consumed. Merv pulls out clean undies out of his pack and offers them around. $5 for a sniff, $10 to wear them. Arms entwined, we bemoan the fact that never again will such giants as we walk the earth. A small voice in the dark mutters darkly about rats and American rope. Slurred promises are made next year to return with helicopter assist. Day 7. Schedules and weariness, not to mention a bad case the night before, catch up with us. We derig everything. The devil-begotten American rope comes up reluctantly, dragging along great tangles of blasting wire. The cave is now clear of all human artifact except for bolts. Most of the crew depart. Merv, Joni, Dale, and Kevin stick around, cleaning up, sorting, burn, and pack, leaving everything tidy. Day 8. After considerable haggling over relative weights and volumes, we pack up all our gear, all the remaining rope, too much garbage, in and on 4 backpacks. We head down the mountain, look like a gypsy's caravan without the caravan. On the way down, we find Gord has been up with a chainsaw and turned the worst parts of the trail into the best. Thank you, Gord. The packs seem to grow in weight as we near the vehicles. Finally, we reach the vehicle. We drop our packs, thud, and enjoy some liquid refreshment. Merv goes off for a piss, and Joni stuffs a great bejesus rock down his pack. Back at Prince George, at Joni's house, we continue the celebration. I wet myself laughing at Merv's face when he finds his rock. It's almost as funny as when I find mine. The road goes on forever, and the party never ends. So that's probably enough. You can do what you want with all that.
Oh, goodness, yes. This has been marvelous. I do have one question before you take off. If you could possibly answer why. Why do you like caving?
Because it's the last place on this poor, tired planet you can still discover something. And you can discover it on a working man's budget. And, well, plus there's the people, plus caves are beautiful, plus, you know, the adventure, blah, blah. But my whole caving career, I've been oriented to discovery. It's sort of unfair of me, but I rarely take beginners caving because if you're taking beginners, there's no hope of discovering anything. So, you know, I know different strokes for different folks, but that's mine.
This is fantastic. This has been great. Is there anything you want to cover before we break away here? Where can you get the book?
For people down there, you order it from Blurb. Google blurb.ca, then you hit the little magnifying glass. The title of the book, Journey to the Center of the Earth, Dale Chase, gets you there. You can order it. I might be at Cave Capers next summer, and if I am, I might order a number of books to try to sell. But one of the things I really don't want, I don't want to order a lot of books, and then 5 years later, I've got 100 books moldering away in my closet.
Yeah.
You know?
I don't want that.
If I break even, that's great. If I don't, well, you know, I didn't write this book for the money. Actually, how this book started, my son and his friend Ryan and I are sitting on the porch one afternoon in last April drinking beer, and I got telling him caving stories. And Darian says, Dale, he says, you got to write these down. You got to write these down. He's pounding his fist. Oh, yeah, right. Maybe I will. And the next morning it was raining. So I wrote a caving story. And then I wrote another one. And then pretty soon I couldn't stop. And write the whole thing, writing the whole book, assembling all the words. Not all of it's by me. I've borrowed some trip reports from other people and, humor from other people, all with permission.
Sure.
But writing it was the easy part. Then came pictures. Oh, my God. People sent me pictures. There were GIFs and TIFFs and PDFs and text files. And my poor computer couldn't understand how to deal with them. So I ended up hiring Sonia to show me over and over how to do this again. She showed me. And then when it came time to edit and actually turn it into a manuscript, she was great. So that's how and why the book happened, I guess, because once it started, I couldn't stop. The Cowboy and the Spittoon. But that's another story.
What better reason to do it? Well, Dale, I really appreciate your time and good luck with the book. And again, go to blurb.ca and search for Journey to the Center of the Earth.
By Dale Chase.
All right. Well, Dale, have a good one, and thanks for coming on the Caving Podcast.
Well, hey, thanks for having me. I look forward to hearing myself. I'm always slightly appalled at my own voice.
Everybody is. It's a normal thing.
Dale Chase, may he rest in peace. He passed away on Monday at his home in Canada. I'll look for a fresh episode coming on June 1st. Until then, I'm Matt Pelser. Kill nothing but time.